the right ventricle especially, it can all of a sudden dilate and function very poorly in these patients. It can happen pretty quickly.
Welcome back to Pete's Grit. I'm Zach Hodges, a pediatric ICU fellow from UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin, a critical care fellow at Children's National in Washington, D.C.
Alice, can you remind our listeners what we do here at Pete's Grit?
Absolutely. Pete's Grit is an educational PICU podcast. We're looking for the best teaching spiels around the country and the world, and we want to put them on the internet for you.
And we have a very exciting topic today. What are we talking about?
Today, we are talking about pre- and post-op heart transplant management. In part one, we're talking about everything from what does the O in OHT stand for to how you support patients pre-op, how you decide to list them for transplant, really everything through the surgery itself. Zach, who do we have today?
We are so excited to have two guests. First, we have Dr. Warren Zuckerman. Dr. Zuckerman is an associate professor of pediatrics and the associate director of the Pediatric Cardiology Division at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons in New York. He completed both his pediatric residency and cardiology fellowship at Columbia. He is now a practicing pediatric cardiologist at Morgan Stanley Children's Hospital. His research interests include pediatric cardiomyopathies, donor and recipient-related issues surrounding pediatric heart transplant, and drug therapies for prevention and treatment of graft rejection following heart transplant.
Yes, and we are so grateful that Gav recruited him for this episode. Gav Apfel is a CICU hospitalist at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. He did his residency at Columbia and will be joining their critical care program next year. And he is interested in cardiac intensive care.
That's right. Such a great episode. So excited to feature these two guys on our show today. Let's get right to the content. Welcome back to the Pete's Grit podcast. We are so excited to have two guests with us today. We have Dr. Warren Zuckerman and we have Dr. Gav Apfel. Welcome, guys. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
To get things started, will you guys tell us something about yourself and include something you enjoy outside of medicine?
So I think anybody who's met me even one time knows that I am the biggest New York sports fan that you'll ever meet.
Nice.
I'm a depressed Giants fan. Usually when I'm interviewing people, one of the first questions I ask people is what their favorite sports team is. So my favorite sports team is the New York Rangers. I'm a huge Rangers fan, season ticket holder. And I was there when they won the Stanley Cup in 1994. And now I have three kids, and I got at least two of them now heavily into the Rangers. I'm proud of that.
Nice.
Yeah, I actually thought Dr. Zuckerman was going to tell us about his undying love for the Philadelphia Eagles. But I guess we'll see how the Rangers shape up against the Leafs tonight.
Yeah.
I've always enjoyed barbering. During the pandemic, I cut all my co-residents' hair. And actually, the first time I met Dr. Zuckerman was I had one of his heart failure patients, so I gave a haircut too. And then we actually met that week.
Oh my gosh. You are such a valuable friend to have.
Yeah. If he didn't add that last part, I was going to add it too. The first time I met him, he was a med student rotating on our service, and he did do that. He was barbering our patients waiting for transplant and playing chess with them.
Oh my gosh.
Correct, Gav? There you go.
Affirmative.
Yeah.
Man, what a great skill to have during the pandemic. So clutch.
Yeah.
that was clutch during the pandemic.
So, Warren, how did you become interested in pediatric heart failure? And then how do you focus your niche specifically within this field?
I've always kind of been interested in cardiology. As I was going through medical school, I was kind of making a decision about whether I was going to do adult cardiology versus pediatrics. And it was kind of natural then to do elective time in medical school in pediatric cardiology, which I did. I kind of always gravitated towards taking care of kids, so I really enjoy that. And I did make the decision to go into pediatrics. And when I did that, I was looking at programs that were strong in cardiology since I had cardiology interests to begin with as well. I ended up here at Columbia. I'm a New Yorker through and through, and this was my top choice. And I do have to say, I think a lot of the career direction is determined by the mentoring you get. When I was a resident here on the cardiology service, I did take an interest in the heart failure patients, especially patients waiting for transplant. And Gav can attest to this too. As a resident here, you become very close to some of the families that are on your team for the entire time you're there. And these transplant patients were there for the full month. You become very close with the kids, very close with the families. And when they get their transplant, it's a big momentous event. So I thought that was really cool. And at the same time, the mentoring from the attending physicians on the transplant team, I thought was excellent. I happened to know Mark Richmond, who was 3 years senior to me. He was a fellow when I was a resident. He was a junior attending when I was a fellow. So I got some of the nuts and bolts mentoring from somebody 3 years senior to me. And in addition, we had Linda Adonizio here, who was the director of the transplant program since its inception in the mid-80s. And when you get mentoring from people like that, and you really like the medicine, and you really like the patient population, I think it was natural for me to gravitate towards that field. I really, within the field, my biggest focus is rejection prevention and long-term outcome after transplantation, such as coronary disease, oncologic issues.
Nice.
And as a clarifying question, you're a heart failure specialist. Is that correct?
Heart failure transplant specialist. So we take care of mostly cardiomyopathies and congenital heart disease with heart failure pre-transplant. We take care of them through the transplant process. I'm not a surgeon. Our surgeons do all the surgical procedures. And we also take care of patients in need of mechanical circulatory support, so ventricular assist devices with congenital heart disease and cardiomyopathy.
Nice. It's hard to hear that and not just think of the person who does this at our own institution, right? Like, I'm sure Zach and I are both thinking of specific people. Do you have any recommendations for PICU or cardiology trainees who want to sort of make the jump to being on the VAD side or the transplant side?
It's a highly specialized field, obviously. And I think you really, really need to love what you do. I think that that's the most important thing. This is a really, really difficult and complex patient population to take care of. I think you use your time as a fellow to become acquainted with a lot of different things. And if this is a field that you really find yourself passionate about, you know, again, it's sometimes long days in the hospital with complex patients. But if you really love what you do, it's really a fulfilling field. I think the people in this field, and it's critical care and cardiologists, heart failure transplant specialists, generally speaking, are really passionate about the field, really, really interested in mentoring the next generation of physicians. And we're also really interested in having help taking care of these patients. Mm-hmm. So especially from a cardiology perspective, the cardiac intensivists that we have here that have interest and focus in this field, it becomes really, really helpful to manage these complex patients when you have intensivists with that specific interest as well. So we're always looking for help. We're always willing to mentor. And if this is what you're passionate about, then you go for it.
Well, and I really appreciate all the answers to your questions. I feel like every time we record, I'm just getting mentored by guests around the country. And I feel like it's a really special part of this project.
That's awesome. Thank you.
A final question with something we try to ask for all of our episodes. Any relevant disclosures or conflicts of interest related to today's talk at all?
None whatsoever.
Perfect. Gav, why don't you bring us in with our case and our first question?
Yeah, sure. All right. So our case, we have a 12-year-old, previously healthy boy who was admitted to the CICU with a concern for newly onset dilated cardiomyopathy. His echo demonstrates severely depressed biventricular function, as well as severe mitral and tricuspid regurgitation. And despite optimal heart failure therapy over 2 weeks, including multiple IV vasoactives, recovery seems pretty unlikely. And then he becomes listed for transplant. So we've certainly seen a lot of these cases in our unit and at CHONY. But Dr. Zuckerman, I was wondering, just broadly speaking, if you could talk to some of the common indications for heart transplantation in children.
Yeah, so the overwhelming majority of patients who need transplant fall into two categories in pediatrics, which is cardiomyopathies and congenital heart disease. When you look at adult heart transplant, the vast majority of those patients have ischemic cardiomyopathy, post-MI type of issues. When you look at pediatrics specifically in the babies, there's a predominance of patients with congenital heart disease issues who are being listed for transplant. So it's a little bit more common than our dilated cardiomyopathies and certainly our other cardiomyopathies. And then as you get older within pediatrics, there's a shift towards dilated cardiomyopathy being the most common diagnosis, accounting for over half of our children and adolescents who are getting transplanted. Recently, for the first time a couple of years ago, congenital heart disease did trump dilated cardiomyopathy as the most common referring diagnosis for pediatric heart transplant across all ages. Restrictive and hypertrophic cardiomyopathies probably account for about 10 to 15% in total of pediatric heart transplants. So when you add dilated and restrictives and hypertrophic cardiomyopathy patients, there is a slight predominance towards cardiomyopathy over congenital heart disease, but it's becoming more of an equal referral diagnosis for transplant. As you get older in pediatrics, you see a little bit of retransplantation being a referral diagnosis for transplant.
Oh, interesting.
And I guess just to piggyback off of that question and what you mentioned earlier with regards to dilated cardiomyopathy, is there a specific time where, you know, these patients who come in, you know, with the severe biventricular dysfunction, you know, is there a specific time where you decide, okay, now we're going to list them as opposed to, you know, waiting to see if they respond to any vasoactive medications or any other oral medications?
Yeah, I would say that when you look at your infant population, you'll see new diagnosis cardiomyopathies come in even pretty sick with really, really poor function. A lot of times they respond really, really well to inotropic support. And if they do, no need for respiratory support, tolerating feeds. We're pretty aggressive in that patient population trying to wean them off inotropes to oral medications. Seems to be a little bit of a different response than you'll see in your older pediatric patients. Some of these patients, if you can get them to oral medications, you will even see gradual improvement in the function in these patients sometimes. It's not very common, but we've seen some babies under one present with even EFs in the teens who actually have normalized function over time on oral medications. Again, that's not the norm, but if you can get those patients to improve a little bit, tolerate oral medications, you can see them actually go a significant amount of time prior to needing listing for transplant, and even in some cases not need transplant at all. In your older patients and your kids and your adolescents, we generally reserve transplantation for patients who are unable to be weaned off of inotropic support. We give, kind of irrespective of what your echoes look like, we give patients a good shot at weaning to oral medications. Of course, we take into account end organ labs, kidney function, liver function, GI function, right? So if you have patients with incessant abdominal symptoms, obviously that's not somebody you would wean to oral medications. But I don't think echocardiographic function alone is a determinant for listing for heart transplant. That aside, you did mention biventricular dysfunction. A lot of these patients who have dilated cardiomyopathy do present with left ventricular dysfunction. Right ventricular function is preserved for quite some time. If you see patients with really severe biventricular dysfunction, I think those patients deserve a hemodynamic assessment. So we oftentimes will cath those patients. And unlike echo, there are definitely some numbers that you'll see on a catheterization that really kind of force your hand. If you see EDPs in the mid to high 20s, certainly if you see elevation of pulmonary vascular resistance, you're starting to think more about transplant sooner rather than later.
Sure. And that's EDP in diastolic pressures, right?
And diastolic pressures, surrogate being pulmonary capillary wedge pressure measurement.
Perfect. I'm interested in maybe just unpacking just a little bit what goes into the process of listing a patient status 1A versus 1B versus 2 or 7. Will you just give us broad strokes? Like what does like IV continuous vasoactives get you? Or like what does mechanical circulatory support get this patient?
There are really three active statuses for heart transplant in pediatrics being 1A, 1B, and 2. In order to be a status 1A patient, you need to be in the hospital where you're listed, with one exception, which we'll talk about. But you need to be in the hospital where you're listed. You need to either be on ECMO or ventricular assist device, or have a breathing tube, or be on inotropic support with congenital heart disease. There's a couple of other things in there. If you have ductal-dependent lesion on prostaglandin as well. And I think if you're under one with restrictive cardiomyopathy, you're also 1A. So those are our 1A patients. The ventricular assist device patients do not need to actually be in the hospital. Patients in pediatrics on ventricular assist devices at home are also listed status 1A. In order to be status 1B, generally speaking, you're talking about your cardiomyopathy patients on inotropic support. Don't have to be in the hospital. So for patients who are on inotropic support, either with cardiomyopathy or congenital heart disease, if you're at home, you're status 1B. For the cardiomyopathy patients, even if you're in the hospital on inotropic support, you are status 1B. Status 2 is everybody else. So patients, generally speaking, listed at home, not on inotropic support, will be listed as status 2. If a center deems their patient to have an illness that is equal to what you would need to acquire each of those statuses, so 1A and 1B, the center can apply for an exception to achieve that status. About a year or two ago, there was the formation of a pediatric-specific National Heart Review Board that reviews these exception requests for 1A and 1B status. So centers can do that as well. Time where we might use that is if you have a cardiomyopathy patient. One of the things that I was just referring to is our patients with very poor hemodynamics or elevated pulmonary vascular resistance. If you are a cardiomyopathy patient with significantly abnormal hemodynamics, abnormal pulmonary vascular resistance, and the center feels that they are requiring transplant on a really acute basis, you can use those hemodynamics as a means for asking for an exception request for 1A status.
Interesting.
Yeah, I had no idea about the way to get an exception for some, for certain patients. That certainly gives great context for what's going on behind the scenes for all these patients.
Yeah. And you know, in terms of deciding like what management strategies for listing, almost always our patients and our families are included in that decision making. There are times where decisions are clear cut. Patients are on ECMO. Patients are needing a ventricular assist device and are being put on a VAD. But there are also times where decisions whether to stay in the hospital versus go home and try to be home on milrinone. Do patients need to be on milrinone right now versus can we try to have them on oral medications for a period of time at home? You know, these are situations where oftentimes we can talk to families and try to do what's best for them. Some families need time to get adjusted to certain diagnoses. Some families have other kids at home that need to be taken care of. When you have the luxury of having that discussion with a family, it's something that I think that centers should do.
Oh, wow. What does your program look like for mechanical circulatory support at home? Do you have kids who are home on these things?
Yeah, we actually have six patients who are home right now on HeartMate 3 LVADs. Destination therapy and bridge to decision therapy with LVADs is it's relatively new in pediatrics, but there are centers who have been doing this for several years. We've actually discharged eight patients, I believe, on HeartMate 3 and in the past HeartMate 2 LVADs. They have been destination therapy for patients who are not candidates for transplant. Patients, the most common diagnosis for that in pediatrics, I think, at least in this center, is Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Mm-hmm. So we have some muscular dystrophy patients at home on LVAD. In the past, we actually had a Duchenne patient who was fairly debilitated, but it was not clear at the time how much of his debilitation was heart failure versus his inherent muscular dystrophy. And mm-hmm. we placed a VAD as a bridge to decision and discharged him. And he made amazing progress on his VAD, was able to rehab significantly, but respiratory status was pretty pristine. And in talking with our neurologic and pulmonary colleagues, they thought that he could live a significant amount of time if we could avoid heart failure. And we deemed him a candidate for transplant. So we did have one patient with muscular dystrophy who we sent home on a VAD who we ended up transplanting. This is about a decade ago. He's now on the adult side post-transplant. And as far as I know, he's doing great.
Wow, that's amazing.
It is. That's remarkable. Hearing a glimpse into what you guys are doing up there in New York. So much fun.
Yeah, it takes a really pretty significant multidisciplinary team. We have a dedicated VAD team. With Sabrina Law as the medical director of our VAD program, we have a nurse practitioner who's really dedicated to these patients and Jenny McAllister. And I mean, referrals to consult services, management of anticoagulation and nutrition and our pharmacists. Like it really does take a multidisciplinary team to take care of these patients as outpatients, but it's something that can certainly be done. I think our adult program manages something like 75 or 100 of these patients, obviously with probably some more resources, but we've got a great team, and it's really good for the patients and the families to be able to provide this service.
Certainly. A glimpse into the complexity for these kids. I want to give you our next question. Generally speaking, what are your goals for a patient going into a heart transplant? How do you want to optimize this patient? What are you thinking on rounds, your goals for these patients leading up to the day they get their new heart?
One of the hardest decisions we make as a team is when to pull the trigger for transplant. You certainly don't want to transplant somebody who doesn't need a transplant. But you want your patient in the best shape possible going into the transplant. Some of the things that are risk factors for postoperative mortality after heart transplant include being intubated, renal failure. Those are two of the big ones. There's other ones that aren't as modifiable, like multiple sternotomies, presensitization, things that we can't change, right? But we're looking to really have our patient in the best shape possible. I think it's also notable that being on a ventricular assist device is actually not a risk factor for poor outcome after transplant. ECMO is, but ventricular assist device isn't. So it's important for us to decide when to pull the trigger on transplant listing based on how sick a patient is. And I think it's also important for us to make a decision about whether we're going to manage patients with mechanical circulatory support versus mostly inotropic support, right? Those are the decisions we're making every day on rounds. So it's what's their respiratory status? What does their end organ function look like? Especially in our younger patients, are they tolerating feeds? Can they be fed? Can they gain weight? And then you're looking at the other risk factors for mechanical circulatory support. Patients with dilated cardiomyopathy, with big LVs and our older patients, mechanical circulatory support is a pretty reasonable option in those patients. But if you're talking about babies You're talking about patients with complex congenital heart disease. That increases your risk from VAD support. Everything is a risk-benefit analysis, and these are the things that we're thinking about when we see these patients every day.
So it seems like you might VAD a patient with heart failure to improve their renal health and their ability to take feeds to optimize them prior to transplant. Is that right?
Yeah. I think if you're on inotropic support and you are sort of thriving, tolerating feeds and have normal renal function, that's a pretty decent situation. But if we're talking about multiple inotropes and either the inability to be fed or abnormal labs, especially renal function, then we're starting to think about putting a VAD in to optimize these patients going into transplant. Other thing is, do you really want patients who are going into transplant intubated for a prolonged period of time? No, I mean, those patients are pretty debilitated. So if, especially in our younger patient population, if they can't be extubated and they're on inotropic support, that's generally speaking a patient that you're looking at putting a VAD into. Again, some of these patients have very complex congenital heart disease, and you know, you're talking to your surgeons, we're talking as a team, we're talking with our intensivists and trying to come up with a multidisciplinary decision for each patient.
Nice. When we think about heart transplant, everything in DC is branded as an orthotopic heart transplant or OHT. How are the surgeons putting the heart in? And then what do we mean by OHT?
I always feel bad for medical students and interns when they present our patients and they see OHT and they say open heart transplant. I pull them aside and tell them, everybody makes that mistake. The O stands for orthotopic. It doesn't stand for open. Orthotopic transplant just means you are putting the transplanted organ in the same place that it's supposed to be. Generally speaking, heart and liver transplants are orthotopic. Kidney transplants are heterotopic. In the past, the distant past, heterotopic heart transplant was actually something that was done. There were transplants done where they put the new heart and connected it to the side of the original heart and left it in. It was a way of managing high pulmonary vascular resistance and extra RV support. I don't believe that's done. That was done maybe 30, 35 years ago here. I don't believe that that's done anymore. And all heart transplants are orthotopic heart transplants, again, which means that the surgeons are removing the original heart, putting the transplanted heart in the same place.
Nice.
In preparing for our conversation today, I found that perhaps there's two main techniques for actually implanting the heart, a biatrial or a bicaval technique. Will you tell us exactly what the differences are and what the advantages or disadvantages might be?
Yeah, so every heart transplant is at least unicaval. The connections that are made on the venous side, the IVC is cut, donor and recipient, and sewed together. The surgeons can do an SVC cut as well and just connect the donor and recipient SVCs. That's a bicaval anastomosis. On the pulmonary venous side, due to the size of the veins, they all come into the posterior of the heart, into the left atrium. A patch is taken, sort of a patch of tissue from the left atrium with the four veins attached, and then that is sewn into the donor left atrium. So there will be some tissue from the original heart from the left atrium. That can actually be done on the right side as well. So a patch of right atrial tissue where the SVC and the IVC come in can be taken, and that will be known as a biatrial anastomosis. At least in our center, when I started maybe 10 or 15 years ago, the surgeons were doing biatrial anastomosis in our younger patients, maybe up to age 2 or 3, because of the size of the SVC and the fact that if you do the caval anastomosis there, you can actually see SVC stenosis in patients post-transplant. It kind of fell out of favor. One of the disadvantages to doing that atrial anastomosis is atrial arrhythmias, and you get a little bit of more tricuspid regurgitation in those patients, just kind of due to conduction type of things. To be honest, it's very minor. We always consider the anastomoses to be equal, and it's really surgical preference. In the last 10 or so years here, the surgeons have done bicaval anastomosis in, I think, every single patient. We definitely do see SVC stenosis, especially in our younger patients, probably say once or twice a year in our babies. We're stenting the SVCs post-transplant, but it's something our cath doctors can do pretty simply, and it doesn't end up being a big deal at all.
That's great. Let me update our case for us. So our 12-year-old male with dilated cardiomyopathy who was listed for transplant actually gets a heart and was taken this morning to the operating room, and they're coming back this afternoon after rounds. So with that, Gav, give us our next question.
Yeah. Apart from, you know, I guess the specifics of the anastomoses, are there any other key information that you want to make sure you receive from the surgical or anesthesia teams when the patient's coming back post-op?
Yeah, thanks. So the team receiving the patient won't get to know very much about the donor. that is kept pretty confidential. The heart transplant team does know we accept the donor, so we do know pretty much the entire medical history and where the heart came from. That's something that is not supposed to be spoken about on rounds or on sign out. But it is important to know certain aspects of the procurement surgery and the transplant surgery as it pertains to the donor. So I think it's important to know, and the surgeons will generally present this and sign out, what they thought about the size match. We know that you can actually transplant a heart that's from a donor that's a lot bigger than your recipient to a little bit smaller. We generally list our patients from 75% their weight to a little bit more than 2 times their weight. So if you have a 100-pound patient, we generally will accept a heart from a donor between 75 and 225 pounds. It's a pretty big range. Obviously, if you're right on the edge of that range and you look at the age and height of your donor, you may actually turn it down for size, but we can take a heart that's from somebody a lot bigger. We like to know that size match. If the heart is big, that can lead to some issues with atelectasis, lung collapse, delayed sternal closure, especially right after surgery, you have edema, you may need to aggressively diurese your patient. So that's something that's important to know. If it's a small size match, the issue when the donor heart is small is basically just keeping up with the circulation, especially when you put it into an environment that is a recipient who just had either cardiomyopathy or congenital heart disease, abnormal pulmonary vasculature, the right ventricle specifically can struggle. So if the size match was a little bit on the small side, it's something that's important to know, especially as it pertains to right ventricular function post-transplant. So that's important to know. We like to know the ischemic time. Obviously, that's something that should be presented as part of sign out, and it does obviously correlate with how far the donor came from. Again, sometimes mistakes occur and you may hear where the donor came from, but it's not supposed to be spoken about. But it is important to know the ischemic time. We generally speaking try to target ischemic times around 4 hours, but certainly up to 5 hours, even up to 6 hours, even in some cases longer than 6 hours can be okay. You will see an inflection point for postoperative morbidity and mortality around the 3 to 4 hour mark, but we're pretty aggressive here taking hearts where we're comfortable with ischemic times up to 6 hours. I will tell you that we can pretty comfortably go halfway across the country to 2/3 of the way across the country for those ischemic times. We can go to Puerto Rico actually and get donors with ischemic times in the 6 to 7 hour range as well. Wow. When we make decisions about donor acceptance, you always think about how sick your recipient is. When you get an offer for a donor and you're pushing the limits for certain things like size or distance, you tend to accept those borderline donors for recipients who are really sick because you think you may not make it to the next donor. That's a natural thing to do. Mm-hmm. You probably will turn those donors down for the patients who are kind of just chilling out on the floor, who you know will make it or you're confident will make it to the next donor offer. Truth is, we probably should do it the other way around, right? You want your borderline offers for your patients that are in the best shape possible going into transplant. It's just not reality. It's not how we actually practice. But going back to the original question, ischemic time is something that's important to know, also because of how the heart is going to react to transplantation. It's a big ischemic hit to a heart to cut it out and bring it over for transplant, implant it again into an environment that can be pretty rough in a patient who had either cardiomyopathy or congenital heart disease. Hearts react differently, but we do know when the ischemic time is longer, the reaction of the donor heart can be sluggish, especially as it pertains to right ventricular function.
When you talk about these ischemic times, it makes me think. My mental model for organ donation was donation after cardiac death. This is probably not a candidate for heart donation. Hearing about your ischemic times and sort of realistically the way these hearts perform in your patients make me wonder if the DCD population would be a candidate for donating hearts. Is that a conversation that's happening, or is it a pretty clear boundary for you guys?
DCD transplantation in adults is something that is being done. It is absolutely in its infancy in pediatrics. I think there have been some cases of it around the country, and it is something, especially with the new devices for organ transport that are being worked on in the adult population, I think it is something that's on the horizon, but it's not a common practice yet in pediatrics.
That's very fair. All right. So we're waiting for our patient post-op, getting the orders prepped, making sure everything's ready to go. What should I ask for when we're thinking about the post-op echo? What specifically do you want to know?
So the most important thing that we want to know is what the function of the two ventricles are. The right ventricular function can really be sluggish, especially in our patients who have elevated pulmonary vascular resistance going into transplant. But the left ventricle as well, again, you can look at your ischemic time, you can look at the environment that the heart is being put into and kind of figure what your post-op function is going to look like. But it can vary dramatically. Some of the hearts just react differently to the ischemic time than others. Some can be quite peppy and some are quite sluggish. And it really, you know, it's crucial to know when you're thinking about your post-operative management.
So one of the mantras that I've heard from a lot of the cardiology fellows that I've worked with on the unit has been like on the first post-operative night to support the right heart. Why exactly are heart transplant recipients at such higher risk for right ventricular dysfunction?
The donor hearts are coming from patients who had almost always healthy cardiopulmonary systems, right? So you're taking your donor heart from somebody who has normal pulmonary vascular resistance and normal lungs. Right ventricle is pumping blood to these healthy lungs and is a nice, happy, and healthy right ventricle. You're then cutting that heart out, ischemic time, and then putting it into a recipient who had either congenital heart disease, most likely Fontan physiology, or cardiomyopathy. This is a pulmonary vasculature that's abnormal. It's been exposed to likely high pressure, it's high resistance. That right ventricle can go in and it can struggle. Again, it's a happy, healthy ventricle to start with, and then it can be overwhelmed. We're very proactive about this in the operating room. It's really crucial that your anesthesiologists are comfortable with this type of patient and this type of surgery. I'm very fortunate to work in a place where the surgeons and the anesthesiologists are extremely comfortable taking care of the absolute sickest patients going into transplant, failed congenital heart disease, ECMO and VAD patients, and they're proactive in the operating room. These patients will almost always come out of the operating room on either dobutamine or milrinone to help support the right ventricle in addition to the left ventricle. And based on blood gases, acid-base status, pulmonary hemodynamics, the anesthesiologist will be pretty aggressive starting nitric oxide in the operating room as well. Our team will come to the operating room, we'll talk with our anesthesiologists and our surgeons and help manage the patients even as they're coming out of the operating room. And it's really important that our team informs the intensivists, the house docs, the nurse practitioners, and the bedside nurses who are taking care of these post-operative patients ahead of the time that they get there. What are the issues? Why are we on the medications we're on? So that they can take a proactive approach as well to taking care of these patients, because the right ventricle especially, it can all of a sudden dilate and function very poorly in these patients. It can happen pretty quickly.
Warren, you've detailed many of the relevant post-operative complications these patients, RV dysfunction, pulmonary hypertension. They, of course, can have bleeding. Any other major complications that is on your mind when these kids come out of the OR?
You just touched on one that we hadn't talked about, but I do think bleeding is a big one as well. And again, how much postoperative bleeding you see in your patients is pretty dependent on what their issues are going into transplant. So of course, we know for our patients who are multiple reoperative patients and have scar tissue, the explant of the original heart can be more difficult, and you can definitely see bleeding issues in those patients. And then additionally, your patients who are going in on mechanical support, especially ECMO with aggressive anticoagulation, can have bleeding issues coming out of the operating room. At least here, and I think it's pretty universal, the surgeons are pretty aggressive taking care of these issues in the operating room, because it's obviously a better environment to do that than in your ICU. But knowing what the chest tube output was in the last hour or two in the operating room is crucial for the team when they get sign out in the ICU. Bedside nurses aggressively following that chest tube output in the first couple of hours, especially after transplant, is very important. It's also important to think about other issues that might exist in your patient as they go to the operating room. Being proactive is probably the most important approach to take with these patients. So our congenital patients can have other issues such as collateral vessels. So what does their last catheterization look like? Do they have a lot of AP collaterals, which would provide a volume load to the transplanted heart? Do they have AVMs? Those patients can come out of the operating room pretty hypoxic, cyanotic. Aggressive nitric oxide therapy in those patients can be very important, and right heart support as well. The AVMs and AP collaterals provide an extra burden to the transplanted heart, which again is a heart that is just taken a huge ischemic hit and may have trouble responding to that anyway. I keep touching on this, but knowing the pulmonary vascular resistance of your patient when they go to the operating room is also really crucial to knowing how your transplanted heart is going to react postoperatively.
Is the arrhythmia burden a big deal for these kids?
Can be. It's also something that's important to note from what the team in the operating room says. When the heart starts up, you can definitely see some both ventricular and atrial ectopy and arrhythmias. It can be a problem. It's helpful to have pacing wires. The surgeons will generally leave that for us, both the atrial and ventricular wires. We will involve our electrophysiology colleagues to help us manage these patients if there's any acute arrhythmia issues in your first postoperative day or two. We do see atrial arrhythmias in the first couple of days to week or so post-op. Sometimes can be related to early rejection, not necessarily. Sometimes we actually see patients who have Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome and pathways, and we didn't notice it on the donor EKG. Pathways can become uncovered, certainly when the heart takes an ischemic hit. Patients may be prone to atrial arrhythmias and you just don't know it. That's something that comes up every once in a while. Our EP colleagues are pretty instrumental in helping us manage these patients.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as replacement for medical advice. The views expressed during this episode by hosts and our guests are their own and do not reflect the official position of their institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at pedescritpodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @critpeds and @pedescrit on Instagram for real-time show updates. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review in your favorite podcasting application and share with your colleagues. Also, if you'd like to support the making of the podcast, please see the description for Venmo information and how to become a Patreon. Any donation will be appreciated. Thank you again for listening, and goodbye.